This is special programming on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Tonight, we'll get an update on the effects of the virus in Butte County from District 2 Supervisor Deborah Lucero. We'll hear about a group of community members who are using 3D printing technology to make face shields for local medical workers. And we'll take a trip to Paradise to check in with NSPR's Kim Weir and see how she's coping through this pandemic. If you have questions, we'd love to hear from you. Leave them on our website or call our message line, 433-9216. For Wednesday, April 1st, 2020, this is special coverage on the coronavirus from North State Public Radio. First, the news.
For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert. The California Department of Public Health has not yet updated its coronavirus numbers today. As of Tuesday afternoon, there were 6,932 confirmed cases in California, and 150 state residents had succumbed to COVID-19. Meanwhile, state prison officials reported 8 confirmed cases among inmates and 25 among guards and other employees. The number of cases locally is multiplying. A patient in Sutter County has died, the second confirmed local fatality. There was one last week in Shasta County. 2 other deaths, both in the Yuba-Sutter area, may be linked to the virus. Both patients have been suffering flu-like symptoms and were tested, but both patients passed away before the results returned from the lab. Public health authorities now report 11 active cases in Sutter County, 8 in Butte County, 7 in Shasta and Yuba, 3 in Siskiyou, 2 in Glenn, and 1 in Colusa. Plumas County reported its first confirmed case yesterday. Lassen, Tehama, and Trinity counties continue reporting no cases. Following developments in Europe and New York City, where field hospitals are going up to help treat an expected flood of patients, Governor Gavin Newsom today announced the conversion of a 1,000-bed Southern California nursing home into a sort of overflow hospital. Like the U.S. Navy's hospital ships, the Orange County facility would treat non-COVID-19 patients, allowing hospitals to focus on patients with the virus. Responding to concerns about the health and welfare of homebound seniors and those considered especially vulnerable to exposure, Butte County this week launched a special courier service, officially named the Delivery Task Force. The service is only available to people confirmed to have active coronavirus infections. The service will deliver groceries, prescriptions, and other necessities. Items must be paid for in advance. Those unable to afford food may receive items from a food pantry. To sign up or learn more, call 211 or Butte County's COVID-19 hotline at 552-3050. United Way of Northern California has said it dispersed $47,000 in grants to groups trying to help out in the crisis. Awardees include Butte County Community Action Agency, Gleaners of Chico, the Shasta College Foundation, and the Yankee Hill Fire Safe Council. A second round of grants is pending. And it's official, public schools won't reopen again until August, at least in Butte County. County Superintendent of Schools Mary Sakuma made the announcement today following a meeting with State Superintendent Tony Thurmond. Also, effective tomorrow, the Shasta County Sheriff's Office's records and civil units will be available by appointment only, and the Sheriff's Office main lobby will be closed to the public. For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Although the numbers are slowly ticking up in the North State, so far our region has avoided a surge in COVID-19 cases, like those happening in New York and other populated areas. But District 2 Supervisor Deborah Lucero says that does not mean Butte County should not be prepared for a spike locally. Yesterday, Lucero spoke with NSPR's Andre Bayek about the effects the virus has already taken on this community and the challenges going forward.
I'm concerned about our level of preparedness. I'm concerned about our very worn out civil servants who've gone through first the dam crisis, then the campfire, and now this, which really dwarfs everything else that we've gone through. So I worry about our frontline workers and our civil servants.
Is there anything that you can think of that can be proactively addressed to address some of those concerns?
Well, what I would like to see our county doing, and we're beginning to do that, myself and Supervisor Ritter were successful in getting our county administration to realize that people need more communication. So I think the first thing that any government should be doing is communicating honestly, transparently, and effectively with the community that it serves. So in that spirit, we asked for a weekly meeting, even two times or three times a week, depending on how critical the crisis becomes, where we will be updated. The elected officials in Butte County will be updated weekly, on a weekly basis, every Friday morning, by our public health officer and director, so that we understand the level of preparedness Butte County is facing. We all have a lot of questions, and we aren't getting those answered because they're very busy just doing the things that they need to do while also making sure that all essential services continue.
Will that update also include updates from our local hospitals here in Butte County?
That is what I'm hoping, because Dr. Miller is the liaison with the local hospitals. And as you know, I mean, I've had many workers contacting me through Facebook or through email, talking about issues that are occurring either at the hospitals or issues that they think may occur in the future when we begin to see our own surge here. We have not yet seen the surge that they've seen in Los Angeles and San Francisco and New York and New Orleans. I'm hoping that we, of course, will not see, you know, those numbers, and I know we won't. But the problem is we simply don't have enough hospital beds or ventilators or PPE to service a huge surge. So it's more important than ever for us to do what we're doing, being socially separate and staying in and really heeding the advice of the White House, as well as our own governor, who continues to keep everybody informed. So yes, the answer is yes, we're going to know more specifically what the hospitals are able to do, what their supply levels are like. That's what I'm hoping for. What is the level of preparedness? Where are we going to house folks? I know that Chico State and the CSU system has been working statewide to give numbers to the chancellor as to what type of facilities may be available on our campus. So I know that there is work being done. I don't know what that plan is, and I want to know what that plan is, because I think we need to communicate that level of preparedness to the community, not so that they can become alarmed or become fearful, but I believe that the more information people have, they can understand where we are at in the process.
Speaking to the point of locating buildings to perhaps house patients in the future, have there been discussions at the county level regarding perhaps maybe looking at fairgrounds or gyms or other areas like that?
I'm sure all of that is in discussion, because those are all of kind of the go-to places that we normally would use in any kind of crisis where we have to shelter people. But because this is a health crisis, it does take a little bit of a different turn, which is that our health officer, Dr. Miller, is really the key person who reports up the command chain, which then goes to the state, and then the state then goes to the national level. So there is, just like in the Army or military, you know, there's a chain of command. And that chain of command starts at the very top, and that's the president. So I think we're a little bit behind the eight ball, you know, because we didn't get some of these measures in place 2 months ago. When at the national level, we knew we had an issue internationally, and we knew that we were going to need a certain level of preparedness, but that didn't occur in a timely manner. And now it's put a lot of our local agencies, it's definitely put the states at a disadvantage. Masks that normally cost 50 cents are selling for $5 a piece.
Do you have any insight into how this virus has already affected the livelihoods of Butte County residents, such as spikes in healthcare applications or food assistance?
Yes. I talked yesterday to the director of the Department of Employment and Social Services, and she said that requests for food and assistance has doubled. So, you know, anything that was a normal figure before has now doubled.
Looking forward, how should residents in Butte County be viewing this crisis?
I think best way for Californians to, and really those in Butte County to view this crisis is, what can I do to help? And if helping means nothing more than honoring social distancing and honoring the things that the experts are telling us we need to do in order to flatten this curve, then do that. If you're able to do more, if you have elderly neighbors or people that you know who are disabled or are in need of help and you can help them, I would suggest doing that. People are getting very creative in their ways to help one another. And I think we need to do that because we have a lot of people on the front lines that have been dealing with disasters for 3 years.
That was Butte County District 2 Supervisor Deborah Lucero speaking with NSPR's Andre Bayek. We're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we'll hear from some of the people helping during this pandemic. Stay tuned. This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. If you listened to last night's program, then you heard us focus quite a bit of the show on personal protective equipment at Enloe Medical Center and the question of whether there's currently enough right now and for a possible surge in the future. That's a story we're continuing to pursue, but one thing we do know is our community is stepping up. Earlier today, NSPR's Christian Solis spoke with Dr. Eric Ayers, professor and chair of the Department of Physics at Chico State. He and some of his colleagues and students are making face shields for medical workers at Enloe, fabricating through 3D printing technology. Ayers first said the project is just getting started.
There are a lot of designs out there on the internet for, you know, here's how to make face shields for your local hospital. But what we're trying to do is, let's start with the hospital and see what they actually need, which design do they prefer. And, you know, important questions like that. We don't want to make a bunch of stuff and then discover it's the wrong stuff or it won't work. Aaron Banwell at the Idea Fab Labs downtown Chico is working on making the actual face shields part. That's the clear wraparound part that goes over the front of the face. And he has materials for that and laser cutter to do it. And then the 3D printers here in the community, here in the physics department and across the university, are working on building the actual, we call them the visor. It's the part that wraps around the head that holds the clear plastic face shield. So we're working on getting that organized now and getting a common design, because what we'd like is for each of these to be interchangeable so they can use the face shields that they're getting from one supplier for the visors that the 3D printers in the community are making. And so we're working on getting that organized.
Where did this idea all come from?
I actually first heard it from one of our physics students who asked me if he could use the 3D printer while he was being sent home because he wanted to do this. And I had already actually taken the 3D printer home when we got kicked out of the campus for the shutdown, because I thought that it might come in useful for something like this. It was just on a hunch. And it turns out that was a pretty good guess. Mm-hmm.
So what is the logistics looking like on setting up everything in the background and getting yourself ready for supplying these hospitals?
So we have a large amount of filament here ready to go for the 3D printers. And currently the point person for the CSU CHECO effort in this regard is Dr. Greg Watkins. He's the chair of the engineering department. He has a lot more industrial and fabrication experience than anyone from the physics department would ever want to have. And so he's the one running that aspect of it and getting us all organized. And my role in this so far has been testing a few designs, making sure they print okay, and you know, advising as to, well, this kind might print more easily than that kind, things like that. And as we get a design stabilized and settled on and, you know, definitely chosen to use, we're going to need more people with printers.
So you guys are making the headpiece while another team is making the physical visors, and that's happening out of the fab lab?
The visors are, as I understand at the moment, the visors are happening at the IDEA Fab Lab downtown Chico. And we're just trying to make sure that everything's compatible between the two pieces.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is we're trying to make the design so that people could, if they don't have an official visor, we could use just overhead transparency film and, you know, a hole punch and make one that'll work. Because we want this to be as flexible as possible. We don't know how bad things are going to get, but we don't want to have anyone be locked into needing a certain part that's not available.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, we'd like for people to be able to modify these and use them as needed so that it works for them.
What does the timetable for a project like this look like?
We have, as I said, a couple of designs that we're considering and working with Enlow to see which one they would prefer that we make for them. And I suspect we will be in production mode by the end of the week.
Are you planning on just making a certain number or just making them as long as they need?
The estimate I've heard is that Enlow is going to need 7,000 of these over the next, well, however long this lasts. Now, obviously, if it lasts longer, then they're going to need more, so we don't know. But we're starting with 7,000.
Where does the money to buy the materials needed for this come from?
IDEA Fab Labs has gotten some funding from the North Valley Community Foundation, and a lot of us are donating time and 3D printer filament to make it happen. That's one of the things we're discussing, though, as far as how we're going to maintain this production of 7,000 of these things.
That was Dr. Eric Ayers, professor and chair of the Department of Physics at Chico State, talking about face shields he and some of his colleagues and students are fabricating through 3D printing technology with NSPR's Christian Solis. If you have a 3D printer and would like to help, you can contact Dr. Ayers by emailing him at eayers@csuchico.edu. That's eayers@csuchico.edu. No act of kindness, no matter how small, is ever wasted. A famous quote I'm sure you've heard. My thought is that it's true because even if your act of kindness ends up helping no one else, the process of doing it often helps you. With that, we'll now head to the Ridge for a reminder from Kim Weir that sometimes it's the small things that get you through another day in paradise.
When it started to become clear what we were all in for, with this new plague, some weeks ago now, I felt confused and disordered right off, just like after the campfire, the last disaster to hit so close to home. So, of course, with news of the coronavirus, I went right there, feeling all that again, what the campfire did to my world and everyone and everything around me here in paradise. But also, eventually, what I did to feel real again. Other people did other things to reclaim their humanity, many of them quite impressive, bigger and better things, it seems to me. Art, sculpture, music, outpourings of human generosity, community performances and memorials, lasting tributes. I've always been embarrassed to tell people what I did to put the world right again. What I did was simply buy a bunch of bird feeders and stock up on bird seed, the good stuff. And then I just kept doing that, which turned out to be the best thing I did for myself all last year, because tending to the birds gave me something to pay attention to think about, beyond the destruction all around me and the endless tedious steps we all needed to take to put things right, beyond my own worries and uncertainty and grief. Because feeding the birds also brought me great joy. Until mid-March, when I moved back to Paradise, part of that pioneering first wave, I made fairly regular day trips. I had to wash the horrible smell off the walls, launder the curtains and everything else made of fabric, and scrub down every drawer and every shelf and every cabinet. I was getting ready to come back home, deeply grateful every day for the fact that I still had a home, which was, and is, a miracle. I even had a neighborhood, other houses and people nearby, which was more miraculous still. When the fire roared through, a small cluster of houses at the end of my street survived because most of them back up to some huge parking lots. But for all the good news, it was still grim in the beginning, colorless and gloomy. Nothing much left of my town but burned-out buildings, dead cars, and tall black poles that had once been trees. Everything was bleak, bare, and muddy. Remember how it rained almost nonstop that winter? And lonely. Mine was often the only vehicle on the road as I came and went. And I tried not to see or smell or hear the shocking silence in the beginning. Tried not to feel the horror. I was just passing through, going to and from my place. But oh, what a party when I got to my place. A bird party. Such a surprise and delight. Later, once I set up the bird feeders, the party really got started and never ended. It was a deep joy just to be there, a privilege to be included in the fly-in, me a mere human, to be included on the interspecies guest list. In no time at all, the birds recognized my old ranger by sight and sound when I came rattling down the road. By the time I pulled into the driveway, birds were everywhere. Birds in the trees, on the fences, a sky full of birds, soaring and swooping, singing and shouting out, birds all aflutter over the free meal that just arrived. Food truck! A heartwarming explosion of song and color and aerial dance. I'd load up the bird feeders first thing when I got to the house, and again before I left, because they ate that much, that fast. Sometimes, if I stayed and worked a long day, I had to stop and fill the feeders halfway through my shift. The birds were that hungry, the food just disappeared. That was the only part of the disaster I focused on in those early days, feeding hungry birds, because it was something I could actually do something about. The birds in my neighborhood were hungry, and I could feed them. So many bird neighbors, none of them too proud for a handout. You're probably wondering what any of that, my meandering story about then, that disaster, has to do with now, this disaster. As it turns out, the birds taught me a lot. For one thing, in a crisis, focus on something other than your own worries. There's nothing to be gained by spiraling down into doubt and fear, and so much good that can come from reaching out to help others, or from just trying something new. For all I know, the birds that entertained me so thoroughly last year had never eaten at a bird feeder before. They tried something new. If this is a good time for you and yours to learn more about birds, if you even have space for a bird feeder, why not? What else do you have going on? Online, the Audubon Society website can tell you what to feed and why and how to keep your feeders clean. Plus, other excellent websites can teach you all about birds, including how to tell them apart by sight and sound and behavior, such as Cornell University's online Lab of Ornithology, ornithology being the science of birds, and ornithology.com, developed by Roger Lederer, the Birdman of Northern California. But something else might suit you better. Whatever hands-on learning project you take on during this time of isolation, be responsible about it. Educate yourself about the basics. Don't break your own heart by leaping into something new with no preparation. I'm thinking about that woman on the news who brought home some fluffy baby chicks for a While the Kids Are at Home project. But she didn't do even minimal research, didn't know enough to provide the hatchlings with a heat source. In general, though, birds are survivors. Not when we set their babies up to freeze to death out of our own ignorance or destroy their habitats through climate change and other environmental havoc, but otherwise, survivors. And truly inspiring as survivors, because they have been around forever. They are dinosaurs, essentially, avian dinosaurs, and have been here since the Mesozoic, more than 66 million years ago, a period that began right after one great planetary extinction and ended with another, the demise of most other dinosaurs. Bird dinosaurs survived because they were able to change when circumstances demanded it, and they're still surviving today, thriving, right outside my window. So let's do the same. Let's be like the birds and change now because we need to. Let's survive, starting with doing whatever we need to withstand this coronavirus challenge. Like the amazing birds at my bird feeders, let's also enjoy the journey. Let's grab onto those fleeting moments of joy, even in these dark days, and share them however we can. You don't need to stand close to be close. Until next time, this is Kim Ware for North State Public Radio. Hold up here in paradise, surviving, and yes, still feeding those birds.
What can I do to get through this pandemic? That's the question I've been wondering as I've been listening to these voices. How can I help someone else get through this? How can I help myself? I can help others by continuing to self-isolate. I can keep shopping for groceries for my parents and others who need me to. I can keep calling my friends and family members, many who I haven't talked to in a while, just to check in and see how they're doing. I can send the package of 3 N95 masks that I have to one of my local hospitals. I can type up that letter I've been meaning to my block in my neighborhood, saying I can do essential errands for anyone who might need me to. I can continue to work with my coworkers remotely and bring you this program and other news every day. For myself, I can make sure I'm taking breaks from the never-ending news cycle, which is hard when you're a reporter. I can eat healthy, I can move my body as much as possible, and maybe get outside and learn a thing or two by observing my feathered friends in my own yard. I guess there's a lot I can do. What about you? And that is your program for Wednesday, April 1st, 2020. We love hearing from you, so give us a call on our message line, 433-9216, or on our website, mynspr.org. Tonight's special coverage was produced by Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Christian Solis, Andre Bayek, and Phil Wilkie. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. Thank you for being with us. I'm News Director Sarah Bohannon, and this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. We're back tomorrow evening at 6:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and whether you're making face shields, helping get someone's groceries or medicine, feeding birds, or just simply staying at home, know that what you're doing is really important, and it's making a difference.